Ultimate Talk Episode 69. Kim Gellert, Scout, New York Rangers.
Another thing we do is we really, there's a lot more to just, can he play hockey now? You get into his schooling, how his family, how he was brought up. So we do interviews a lot more than when I first started. It's gotten a lot more complicated.
Die Tribüne erhebt sich. Und der Hexenkessel kocht. Da bleibt kein Moment, um einmal durchzuatmen. Bring it on. Mit dem Torhänder abgefälscht und die Scheibe im Tor. Aus dem Nichts. Wie schön war das gemacht.
Unibet Hockey O'Clock. I wanted to do this for a very long time, and now the day is finally here. We're finally being introduced to the big business that is scouting, and finally by someone who does it for an NHL team. It's none other than Kim Gellert, who's a scout within the New York Rangers organization. And Kim, I'm so honored that you're gracing Unibet Hockey O'Clock with your appearance.
Well, thanks for having me, Martin. Happy to be here.
Kim, we're recording this conversation a couple of days after you've already been introduced to an Austrian audience. You talked to us a little bit about the Buffalo Sabres and everything that went on when you worked for them in the scouting department, obviously on our show at the Heritage Classic that we were able to broadcast on Pulse 24. How did you become a scout?
Well, the scouting fraternity is usually done by, not really if you've played hockey or if you played in the NHL or were a manager in the NHL, which obviously does help. But very, very often it's a friend of yours that had been in the business that gets you the position. And a lot of times that person, if they do move, say management, then they would like to bring their guys that they trust. So it has a lot to do with friendships is how it happens. Just like how I got on this podcast. I have a friend, Greg Holst, who got me on this with you, Martin.
And I'm very thankful for it and that he did it. But was it something that you could have envisioned after your pro career had ended, or was scouting or becoming a scout just something that you stumbled into?
No. Well, what happened actually is, once again, a person that I played with in the Italian league when we played in the Alps, with Varese, one of the players became a general manager of first of all, a head scout of a team with the Buffalo Sabres. And he is the one that eventually, when he left Buffalo, actually went to another team. He got me a position because I was doing what you call bird dogging for him. He wasn't able to get into Kelowna to watch the games. So he said, okay, this player is coming in. Could you do me a favor and go and watch the game? So that's how I would do it. Just go and watch a couple of games for him. And then when he left the organization, someone asked, do you know anyone out west that could do this for us? And me being out west in Kelowna, I was the one that they decided to hire. So
you've already touched a couple of topics that I want to eventually get into. Your playing career in Italy, a couple of decades ago, your scouting career that already spans a couple of decades as well. Looking back on how you got into the business of being a scout and being one in 2022, how has the business changed?
Well, it's so interesting because what happened is when I first started with the Buffalo Sabres, the game was still into the heavy, bigger guys and not quite as skilled. And that being 14, 15 years ago, 13, 14, whatever years ago, And we had a team in Buffalo that won the President's Cup. And the team was a couple of small forwards, but very, very skilled. We went into the playoffs. And because the rules do change a little bit, as everybody knows, in the playoffs, the referees are a little more lenient and there's a little more clutching and grabbing, especially back then, that the smaller team, we found that, okay, we have to get bigger again. So what you do is, this is how it just comes full circle, because then all of a sudden we started getting bigger again. Teams were, you know, building for the playoffs. Because during the season, you want that skilled team to get you into the playoffs. And then you need a little bit bigger. And now it has changed again, where they have changed the rules. I shouldn't say they've changed the rules. They've just decided to call the rules. The rules were always there. They just would let them go. Now it's a little bit, or quite a bit more, where they can't, if you dump it in, they can't block you up too long. Okay. They can interfere a little bit, but not like they used to. They used to be able to clutch and grab. Anyway, it has come a full circle. And as scouts now, you have to look for both. You can't have too much on your team, too much of small and skill. You also have to have the big, strong, stronger guys. But nowadays too, the strong, big guys can skate. They can play. They're really, really talented. Not that they couldn't back then, because it was a different game.
Now, you've already touched on a lot of things that I also want to tackle, because scouting and the evolution of it is so interesting, because there are so many talented players that are coming out. But the question, and you've already kind of alluded to it, trying to get bigger, then rules getting tweaked, maybe organizations now looking for more skilled players. Is there a clear-cut evolution of a player's type? Are they all getting bigger and more skilled, or do you think at one point it's going to revert back to smaller sized athletes? Maybe the skill takes over, then again the size takes over. How do you think it has already evolved, and where do you think this evolution is heading?
Well, it has already evolved. There are quite a few I'm going to say small players. And once again, I mentioned it earlier, you can only have so many per team, okay, small and skilled. But now the medium size, say the 6'1", 6'2", or 6-foot players are very, very highly skilled also. So it's you need both. But now the size guys are really, really skilled. And if you have to be exceptional, if you're a small guy, it's gone a little bit back to that, I think, anyway, for the playoffs especially. But there are some the skills that are coming out now, it's unreal what they're allowed to do. Whereas even before, I want to add this, because you would be, if you picked up the puck on your stick like they do now, from behind the net, if you did that back in my day or our day, my and Craig, you know, you'd be looked poorly upon. You would be, and guys would just run you and slash you and say, don't pull those moves. I actually had that happen once to me in Italy, as I made a move on a player. I won't say his name, but it was a back pass into my skate. It looked like I was passing it to someone else, and he went for it, and I just kicked it back up to my stick and went in on a breakaway and scored. And he said, don't you ever pull any more of those peewee moves on me. So even if something as small as that, he wasn't allowed. Now it's allowed, and I love it, obviously. I was a skills guy, so I just love it.
I just wanted to say we're not only a skills guy, you're also a skills coach right now. So a lot of things are blending together when talking to you. And just the one thing that you alluded, that you need skill, especially during the regular season, and even quote unquote diminutive guys now get a real chance proving their skills in the National Hockey League. But then in the playoffs, you obviously need size, and the game is called differently. I remember that one stat from last year's playoffs that Connor McDavid drew a dozen, two dozen, three dozen penalties during the regular season, but none during the playoffs, or almost none. How difficult is it to bridge that gap as a scout looking for skill and then knowing in the back of the head he needs to have a certain physicality to him to succeed in the pros and especially in the playoffs?
Yeah, and that's and that is very difficult, Martin. Like I say, you want a team to get you to the playoffs, and then it's almost like you need a bit of a different team to help you win the playoffs. So it's a fine line. You want to get both, but you favor a little bit. If it's close, you'll favor the big guy, even if he's not quite as skilled. At least that's my thinking.
You've already talked about your playing career, and obviously you're good friends with Greg Holst. Both of you found a hockey adventure, quite literally, in Austria and in Italy. I know the story, and he's told it many times, how he ended up in Austria, but how did you, as a Canadian hockey player, end up playing in Italy, of all countries?
Well, I grew up in a small town, 2,200 people in northern Ontario, and at least half of them were Italians. Mind you, they were Italians from the south. So, and living in an Italian community and then going to Lake Superior State, I had the opportunity to go play in the OHL, Ontario Hockey League, major, junior, or to go to school. And my mother really wanted me to go to school. So I wanted to please my mom, and I went to school. So at Lake Superior State, and when I was at Lake Superior State, which is in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, I played with Giulio Francella. I don't know if you remember that name, but he also played in Italy. And he said, I went and tried out for the Maple Leafs, and I tried out for the Islanders, and they kept sending me back to the minors. And I kept going back to Italy. So it was Giulio Francella who got me to Alleghe. So my first two seasons were in Alleghe.
How does this work out? You growing up around a South Italian community, and obviously their mentality and their way of life is very distinct and very unique. And then playing a sport that's basically only popular in Northern Italy. How does one have to envision a person socialized by and within South Italian circles in North America coming to Northern Italy to play hockey?
Well, it's funny, the difference, because Southern Italians that came to Canada, or at least to where I grew up, they're all short and dark. So I got to Alleghe, and I thought I was in Sweden. I'm going, what is this? They were tall, they were blonde, and in the I remember the team pictures. I would bring the team picture home, and the guys would say, "Well, you look more Italian than the Italians."
What was the first, apart from maybe not looking the part or them not looking the part, but what was the first uniquely Italian experience that you made on Italian soil? And mind you, we're talking about the mid to late 70s.
Well, the biggest thing was the difference in the quality of players. We had players that, like the first line Back then, we were only allowed two imports per team. And then the Italian Canadians or Italian Americans came into play also. But the first year I went, so we had a goaltender and myself were the only two foreigners. And the difference was they all worked. They all had jobs. So, you know, here we'd go to practice and only sometimes there were three guys would show up during the day, the morning practice, because everyone had normal jobs. So that kind of shocked me a bit. And then like playing, you'd play the first line against the other team's first line, which was, you made sure you did that because the second line was not nearly as good. And then the third line, well, holy smokes, it was, you've got a peewee team out there against, you know, guys who could play in the East Coast League, professional hockey, and the difference was enormous. And one of the things I found is that we got played a lot, which I loved. You know, the coach would put us on the ice all the time. And I remember two games in Allegheny. One game I played 60 minutes. One I played 58 because I got a penalty. But I did not get off the ice. I would go on the first line. And then I play defense on the second line, back on the third line, defense. Never got off the ice. It was like I said, I loved it. And no wonder you score so many goals. You're on the ice all the time.
This is as throwback as it gets. And I remember quoting the other day on air a fact that I stumbled across when preparing for one of the NHL broadcasts on Pulse 24. The old Pittsburgh Pirates, and it's not the baseball team, there used to be a hockey club in Pittsburgh in the mid-30s, in the mid-20s to early 30s, I think, that was called the Pittsburgh Pirates. And the coach of that team, and his name tends to escape me, he was the first who used line changes because up to that point, the best teams kept their best players on the ice all the time. And that's how slowly but steadily in the pro hockey game, the line change evolved. But I know every player wants to play as much as possible, but when playing for 58 or 60 minutes, was it ever too much? And how did you try to conserve energy when playing a full game?
You know, and that's what I would do. I would play back on defense for a rest is what I would do. So I even had trouble skating backwards, but seriously, I did try and take it easy, try and just play defensively and move the puck the way a defenseman would. And like I said, I was lucky enough that I was able to do that. And the first couple of years we had good success in Allegheny. It was a lot of fun.
Now, of course, our good friends at Unibet, they're also looking at different stats. And some of the stats that popped up came from Gadadina, where you also played among other places. You played or you came around in Italy quite a bit. And the numbers that you posted at Gadadina especially stand out because you at times scored at a pace of almost 4 points per game. Does the game, and you've already alluded to it, that you, of course, played a lot of minutes and therefore scored a lot, but does it ever get boring or does the game ever stop being fun when you're just so dominant that you're putting up 4 points almost every game?
You know what? Maybe I was, I don't know. I just loved to score. I just loved it. And never ever got tired of it. I remember my dad telling me one time, he used to play darts with me. And he would say, you know, try with every dart. He said, try with every dart. And it's the same as letting up. Don't ever let up in anything. And when I was playing, you know, if it was maybe I would probably pass a lot more if the game got out of hand. Which it rarely did when I was in Gardena because Bolzano was always right there. So they were tough games, but I just loved to score. And, and be on the ice. I would look down at the coach every time I got off the ice. I'd look down to more or less tell him, hey, I'm ready to go.
Now, I know talking to Greg that the late 70s, the early 80s, the 80s, even the early 90s, they were, for Canadians or for a lot of import players, Europe and especially the quote-unquote smaller leagues, Austria, Italy, were considered being a little bit like one would envision the Wild West. How much Wild West was in Italy at the time you played hockey there?
Well, there was quite a bit of Wild West. For example, fighting was not allowed in Italy. And I sure don't know why. It was a lot more dangerous than playing over here, because kicking was allowed, spearing was allowed. I remember the first 4 years I was in Italy, I got kicked out of the game I was playing and two other games. We only played 28 games at that time, for punching a guy in the head with my glove on. So, which didn't hurt him at all, nothing. But I can also remember being on the ice with a fella's brother, and I'm on top of him, and he came and he kicked me in the back, and he got I had a gash in my back, and he got a 2-minute penalty. So, and another incident is I got a guy slashed me in the hand and broke my hand, and he got 2 minutes. And like I say, the 4 years in a row, I punched a guy and got 2-game suspension. So the stick wielding, you started to learn how to play over there. And I did get, I wasn't a physical player, but if anyone did something to me, then the little switch went off and the stick came out and I started playing like a little lot more spearing, a lot more stuff that I shouldn't have done, but I played there for so long, you just learn how to do it. And I just want to go back to the last question. I learned so much about skills when I went over there. I was skilled, but I was never as skilled as a lot of guys. Like I can remember playing with Gianfranco Rudatis, Renato De Toni, who were older, much older than me, but they, I scored at least 15 goals from Renato De Toni going behind the net and passing it back the way he came out and into an open net, that he was like he was a magician, but like he was older and like I say, picking the puck up on your stick. When I played in Gardena, the things that we played against a Czech team and it was in the summer and was just exhibition game, but we used to flip the puck up on our stick and catch it in our hand. Well, they would just slide it onto their blade. I was watching the practice. Then that night, sure enough, a guy comes down full speed, pulls it onto his blade, flips it over our defenseman's head, and our defenseman, sure enough, he looks up. The guy skated around him and goes in and scores on a breakaway. I said, that is the coolest thing I saw. That I was 25 years old at the time, but I'm in 67 now. And I learned how to do that. And they're doing that. They're just starting to do that now. Whereas if you watch a game, Zegras pulls it on his stick from behind the net and flips it. They were doing that 40 some years ago in Europe. They were doing that. So I'm just trying to tell you how much I learned, or how much you can learn from different countries and different players.
I want to dive into that topic as well, but just because you mentioned you playing in Gardena and obviously playing together with one of the iconic players in Italy's history, with Aro Vinzam, going against the teams of Bolzano, and Bolzano always being the team in northern Italy. But then again, you being there for 1.5 decades and moving around a lot, seeing different places, how did Italian hockey change, evolve in those 1.5 decades that you were there?
Well, the way it changes, they opened it up to the Italian Canadian and the Italian American, and maybe, you know, too much. There just wasn't enough hockey taught to younger kids, and there wasn't a vision for the kids to say, they played soccer, so why should I play hockey? And there just wasn't enough for them. And so the evolution came that okay, yeah, sure, a lot more Italian Canadians played, but the Italian coming up said, okay, you know what? I don't have a chance anyway. I'm going to play for a few years and then I'll quit. I'll go play soccer or tennis or something. That's what I think that happened with Italian hockey. But when we were there early, the mid years, it was such good hockey. It got to where, like I say, the first couple 2 years with Allegate, and then things started changing. Then I went to Gardena, and we were allowed, two, and then an extra Italian Canadian, and then it was two foreigners and two Italian Canadians, and then or two Italian Canadians, or Americans, it just kept getting bigger and bigger that way. And all of a sudden, a lot of money got put into the teams. And now you've got ex-NHLers coming, Mark Napier, you've got Bolzano and Bostrikov and Maslennikov and some guys that were like super, super players. So it got so much better. Like I say, there are so many guys, you know, I couldn't name all of them right now, but you went back to Bolzano, how it was with them. It was, they had so many and good young players. And then they had, you know, rest in peace, Gino. He was such, Pascolotto was, such an inspiration, even for me playing against him. You know, he just played so hard all the time, you know. And the Gasters, I've got a picture up on my wall with there's Gino. I see Gino, Norbert Gasser, and Martin Pavlou when we were playing Gardena, and the fans, they were just so good.
And that's something very interesting, and I'm glad that we stumbled across Gino Pascolotto, because he's still to this day the only retired number, at the very least, that's openly shown or hanging from the rafters in Bolzano Stadium. And just a couple of weeks ago, on air, the latest great captain of HC Bolzano retired and told us that on our show. To a lot of people, Gino Pascolotto is just a number at Bolzano Stadium. But you, as someone who played against him, saw him perform his magic. What was so special about Gino Pascolotto?
No, it was the drive that he had. I said I'd love to score goals. He loved to play the game, loved to win, and just a. Like I say, the drive that he had, he played hard. As scouts, we say, we look for guys that play hard. We would love to look for a guy like Gino Pascolotto. He could shoot the puck. He could make passes. He wasn't a great dangler. He wasn't a great puck dangler. But he played hard. Around his net, you knew if he's out there, you're getting a cross check in the back. He played hard. And after the game, we'd go out and have a beer. It was like play hard, cross check in the show in the back and wherever after the game, let's go have a beer. That was Gino Pascolotto.
I want to return to the program in a bit, but first, after we've already talked about our great friends at Unibet, there's a special offer for all the listeners of Unibet Hockey O'Clock. Unibet provides every new customer with a 400% welcome bonus. Just log on to Unibet, put 10 euros into an account and get 40 euros extra on top by submitting the promo code hockey-bonus. Further information in the show notes of this podcast. Unibet, by players, for players. And when we talk about players, Kim, and I'm so glad that you're educating this audience and myself, obviously, about scouting and everything that goes into it. What were the takeaways? You said you learned so much from Italy, but what did you learn, or what one key component did you learn in Italy that helps you until this day in your job as a scout?
What it helped me do is look for those players, look for guys like Gino, look for guys like Martin, look for skilled guys, look for guys the Bolshakovs, the Maslennikovs. Maslennikov wasn't the skilled guy like Bolshakov was, but you also look for guys that, okay, who does he play really well with? Okay, like Bolshakov, Maslennikov, if they weren't together, they weren't as effective. So you know, as a scout, you look, okay, this is a winger. He can either do it himself or he really needs someone to get him the puck. So that's probably the biggest thing that I got. I got that and like I say about Gino, about someone who plays hard. Okay, so those are a couple of the things that I took out to Italy. And another thing that I learned is the language.
And that helped you, especially in the year of 2010, if I'm not mistaken. Would you care to elaborate before we're reverting back to a little bit of scouting?
The Olympics? Oh my gosh, that was such a great experience. And Jim Corsi did the first half, and then I was did the second part of it. And I was there when Crosby scored that winning goal against the U.S. And I just I just screamed, goal, 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 goal. And I got so many emails from my friends in Italy saying, you idiot. You know. But anyways, it was a very good experience.
You did commentary for Italian television at the Olympics. How, I mean, so it's already been more than 10 years, or we're looking at 12 years right now. How proud are you still of this accomplishment, being on TV for one of the ultimate hockey moments of this century?
Well, I'm not proud of myself. I'm just proud of, like, being able to speak the language. And because when I went over there to Italy, I said, no, I was lucky to be put in Allegheny where nobody spoke English. So I went around with the dictionary and I learned it. So I'm proud that way that I learned the language. But as far as that goes, it was just, didn't realize it until after, if you know what I mean. Okay. Jim says, do you want to do it? And I said, nah. Yes and no. I wasn't going to jump on it, but I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And then once there, my gosh, watch all the women's games too. It was very, very, very good.
Just because of the fact that you spent so much time abroad, and this is something that young kids are being taught nowadays. Try to get experiences in foreign countries, try to learn other languages. And that just wasn't the usual way of playing hockey abroad, learning other languages, especially for someone who grew up and learned the game in Canada. When looking back, but also looking at what you're doing right now, how valuable has the time abroad been for you personally? And how has it changed the way you look at players and certain traits in players?
Well, what it's done with me is I was, you know, because I look at my son who was born in Italy and then we moved to Canada when he was six, and now he learned the language when he went to school for 2 years in Italy, as did my daughter. So they both know the language to this day. And then he went back and played in Asiago, and well, in Italy, and for what, 8 years, and he went over there with no problem, knowing the language, and so that's huge. But then looking at players, I keep going back to the difference in there can be the statures, guys can be big. And nowadays, what has changed more than anything is the speed and the skill. And when I was over there, I got to see a lot of players who were really fast and really skilled. And even to this day, you can see some guys that aren't that fast, but are so skilled and have great hockey sense, which is one of the most important traits of a player. So as a scout, you have to, for me, I have the compete. I have the Gino Pasqualotto there. I have the skill, Greg Holst, the puck skill, and then the hockey sense. You know, hockey sense is, you know, right there, skating, hockey sense, compete are the top three by far. Four. A scout, and I saw all of that when I was growing up in Italy.
Now, what's so interesting about the job of a scout, about the profession, the terms that you already mentioned, these are so hard to quantify. Of course, it's a stats-driven business, but there's nothing that really quantifies hockey sense, that really pours grit and compete into numbers. Now, you go into a game expecting nothing out of anyone. What are the first kind of things that you're trying to look for, that you're trying to focus on?
Well, the first things, Martin, the first things that jump out at you will be the speed. Obviously, you look for that, but you will see the guys that know how to skate, and you'll see the guys that know how to stick it. Like you said, it's really difficult to tell if they're the hockey sense. Where's the hockey sense? It'll take you a few games, not one or two. It'll take you maybe five games to figure out, okay, that's why this guy is a really good skater and a good puck mover, good shot, but he doesn't know the game. He's not sure where to go, okay, without the puck. He's not sure where the guys are before he gets the puck, so those are things that you'll see the skating first, and like I say, the shot or the puck skills, you'll see that, and then it'll take you a while to catch on to the hockey sense. But those are the things you look for. Not even as much puck skill as compete and hockey sense. If you compete, and even though your puck skills aren't good, if you know where to go and where to be, where to put the stick to block shots, that's very valuable, because you can play on the third and fourth line. You don't have to be a top six player.
Now, you've been working for NHL organizations now for 15 years. You've been part of the Buffalo Sabres. You're now part of the New York Rangers. When you go out to scout prospects, to scout players that might be interesting for your employers, how long, or once you focused on a prospect that's of interest, how often do you try to watch him? How long does it take to get a really good feel for him? You've mentioned that five-game threshold. On average, is that the amount of games that you want to see, or do you want to see as many as possible?
Well, that's funny you bring that up, Martin, because more this year, I think, than any other year, I'm finding that I was really high on a few players who I've seen. You know, I see the first five times, you give them a grade, and it's a pretty good grade. And you look, now we're getting near the end of the season, and you look and you see, and geez, you know what? This guy's not improving. So you have to think, okay, has he reached his maturity? Is he done? He didn't get any better. you know, and he got as good as he was last year. And this happens quite a, not that often, but whereas a kid as an underage, so we're when he's 16 years old, he had a real good year. And then when he's 17, getting ready to be drafted, okay, now he's not any better than he was last year or from the start of the season. So I'm finding that it's taking more games, like, and it's a process. So you just have to keep watching the guys. And a lot of people in our community, you know, scouting community, they say, you know, oh, maybe you've seen him too much. Well, I don't never agree with that. I don't think you see a guy too much. You can keep seeing him and you see, okay, this guy he's not competing like I thought he was going to this season, because last year he was good, his skills were good, now his skills are good, but he's not any better because he doesn't compete.
What are red flags? Now you get the job of having to look at someone. What are the first kind of red flags that jump your eye?
The first for me is to compete. Okay. If a defenseman's going back to get the puck and it's really close, it's not an icing, it's really close, and he pulls up a bit, gives the other guy the chance to go in and get the puck first, that's a huge red flag. Because I think if you have some fear, you've got to be smart enough to, okay, this guy is going to crush me. You know, you don't want to get crushed all the time neither. So hockey sense, guys with real good hockey sense don't get hit hard. Okay, so once again, a fine line. But if you keep seeing it, you see, okay, he's letting up, and there's no way this little guy was going to crush him. So those are red flags. Red flags, and another thing we do is we really, there's a lot more to just, can he play hockey now? You get into his schooling, how his family, how he was brought up. So we do interviews a lot more than when I first started. It's gotten a lot more complicated because you want to make sure if you're picking a guy, you know, we're talking billions of dollars for franchises and what they spend. And if you're picking a guy and he's a jackass, you want to know that before you pick him, or you don't pick him.
Would you be able to narrow it down to maybe a time or an incident or a decision where the life of a scout turned more into a life of a private investigator than just someone who rates someone on the ice?
Well, a private investigator, I don't know. Should have hired a couple. But
you know what I mean, or what I'm trying to get to.
Is no, not really. I don't really understand what you're trying to get to.
That with all the interviews and all the background checks and trying to be extra careful in trying to find out everything there is about this one person. At what point did this really, really start to take over?
Yeah, well, it is, like you say, that as far as the interviews go, because what we do is we don't just talk to the player himself, we talk to the coach, you talk to the equipment manager, who is probably with the players more than anybody. So you talk to him, you talk to the assistant coach, you talk to their billet family. They're not from home, so they're not from that city, so they're at a billet family. You talk to them. It's like you say, it is a bit of a private investigator, yes, in that way. That,
now, you've been part of the Rangers organization, and I want to talk at the back end of our conversation a little bit about the scouting department itself and how it's constituted. But the Rangers are an interesting case study because you could argue that they've got blue chippers at every level. You've got a Vezina Trophy favorite with Igor Shesterkin. You got probably one of the best blue line defensemen in Adam Fox. You got one of the great goal scorers of this day in Chris Kreider. Does that mean, or does having those players also for the foreseeable future, does it mean approaches in what players might be of interest change? Or are you still looking for the next blue chip goaltender, the next blue chip defenseman, the next blue chip goal scorer.
Exactly. That's what we're doing. We're always looking for the best player available. If we have a couple of small defensemen, we say, okay, let's maybe the forward is just as good as this guy or really close. You take a forward, maybe. But with the New York Rangers, it's always, and not just the New York Rangers, with every team, Martin, what it is now with the salary cap, it's very difficult and makes so much or the general manager's decisions are so important and makes it so much more difficult for general managers where is this guy going to fit? Okay, this guy is coming up, there's his contract, and this guy and this guy. Yeah, we have a really young team, like in New York or any team that has guys coming up for contracts. You say, we're not going to be able to afford him. So what we have to do is try and maybe if you trade someone, I'm not saying New York can trade him, but a team in general, if they're going, they might see that, okay, this guy, we won't be able to keep him. And we have a guy maybe just like him. So we have to trade him. He's going to want too much money, put us over the budget. And now you take something that you hope you either draft picks or something a little bit younger that you say, okay, geez, you know, here we go. This, you have to take chances. And that's the biggest part right now is which obviously makes more parity in the National Hockey League.
I know you're not at 100% liberty to speak about all the processes that go on within an NHL organization. That's perfectly all right. But on average, and it's probably really hard to say, but how many years does an organization have to think ahead? Is it 1 year? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? Especially because of the fact that you're basically looking at teenagers, that you're trying to put forward teenagers that need to be drafted, that need to be in a system, that need to get game ready for the National Hockey League. Is it even possible to say what number of years it's good to be looking ahead to?
Well, it's impossible to know exactly because some players, they develop later. And so what I personally think is that you have to wait at least 5 years. If you draft a guy, you have to wait at least 5 years to see, because a lot of times a player will go, he might be a second rounder or a first rounder. He'll play in the NHL and then all of a sudden, you know what? He's not good enough. Guys pass him by, but you give him a really good chance because he might be a second rounder. So you keep giving him a chance. And then eventually you have to cut the cord. But I say, and this is just me just guessing at a number, at least 5 years before you think you have a player. And some of them will jump right out. Now the game has got so much younger also because of the salary gap, because the first 3 years they can only make a certain amount of money.
And one of my other jobs, I do follow the National Football League, as in American football, quite a lot. And I know it's apples and oranges to a certain degree, but the interesting part about the NFL and the scouting process is that obviously draftees need to spend 3 years in or at a college. How would that impact? And I know it's something that's not real in hockey right now, but how would it impact scouting if prospects were to spend 3 years at an institution of higher education playing there to be draft eligible?
Well, even now, in some instances, for some teams, it's better to leave them in college. That way you don't have to sign them so early. And then a lot of guys, like I said about development, like free agents that go to college, and all of a sudden when they're 22, 23 years old, they're better than the guy you picked who was 18, and now he's 23. So it's just, like I say, it takes time. But as far as the colleges go, I think it helps their development so much. And some guys will go for 1 year, but that'll be, you know, guys that, you know, that'll will play and that are already men physically and mentally. So
now when I'm preparing my notes to do commentary on NHL games, I'm always trying to jot down where he played his junior hockey, if and where he played his NCAA hockey. And just the past couple of years, it seems as if more and more players spend time at NCAA institutions. Is that an isolated observation that might be wrong on my end, or is that something that you scouts see as well, that more and more people don't jump directly from one of the junior hockey leagues to the NHL, but try to use the NCAA and other institutions to get their game NHL ready?
Yeah, once again, like we said earlier, I think what it does is it matures them and gives them time to mature. A lot of players, if they come right to, you know, from junior hockey to the NHL, now they're expected to be really good, and they still have a lot of work to do on their development. And that's why I think a lot of teams do a good job at getting the players to either the American Hockey League or even the East Coast League to have them develop. Okay, so yeah, NCAA is there for that reason. It, you know, your schooling is paid in case you don't make it. Okay, which is, but also the Western Hockey League, for example, and the Ontario Hockey League, the CHL in general, they also have a plan that if you don't make it professionally, you get your schooling paid for.
One thing that people tend to overlook with scouts is obviously the travel part and trying to have to see as many games in sometimes as little time as possible. Is it always fun, or are there parts of the job where it stops being fun?
You know where it's fun, Martin, is when you feel like you're part of a team, even if it's the scouts. You get together after, you talk about the game. You don't talk about the players. We don't share any of our notes with other teams. But it's the camaraderie that you kind of need. You get on the road. You're on the road for a few days. Some guys go on the road for 2 weeks, And so that part is really nice. You go out and have a beer after the game, and have some food, and then maybe the next day there's a snowstorm and you have to drive 2 hours, and you're it's on a highway that you can usually go 120 kilometers an hour, and you're down to 50, and it's dangerous. Mind you, the teams are really good that way, is that they never want you to go if it's dangerous. And you, a lot of times you don't, but a lot of times you say, I've got a, a big truck, I've got a four-wheel drive, I'm going to make it. It's just what you do is you leave early. For something that takes you 2 hours to get there, it's going to take you four. So yeah, you just plan on that. But it's and windy and you can't see sometimes. Like I say, you're going 50, 30 kilometers an hour. But it's other than that, it's usually and one other thing is the planes. Your plane's delayed, so you miss the connection. So you have to so many changes that have to be made. You have to phone your travel agent. They try and get you on the plane so you get to the next game. If not, okay, you have to switch. And lately it's been, you've had to switch because, okay, that game got postponed because of COVID. And so it's, yeah, no, it's not just a lot of fun all the time, but it can be enjoyable.
So to all the people at the arenas, next time you see a scout, be nice to him. Their lives and travels and their work life sometimes is a little harder than one might think. But when talking about scouts and scouting departments, you are working as a scout for the New York Rangers. You're one of more than a dozen people who do so. And the Rangers, mind you, are no exception to to this rule. All the 32 NHL organizations have huge scouting departments. How is one constituted? How many scouts are working which area? How does it work, or how did it work at organizations that you were part of?
Yeah, it depends on the organization. A lot of teams have more scouts than others. We have a couple of like part-time scouts in the West. We need more because it's a vast area to cover. So we have three. There are three of us that scout, and myself. I'll do the part-time. I'll do the BCHL, but mostly it's just the area scouts that'll watch the Western Hockey League, for example. Myself, and there's another guy that'll just watch the Western Hockey League. And then we will have other scouts. They will watch every league and go to Europe. Okay. Like our head scouts, they will go to Europe. And so their travel, they're away from home. At least 200, 250 of the 350 day, 4 days. It's unbelievable. How much travel they have to do. I'm at a stage right now where for me, the part-time is already a lot, and it's good. But to your question, yes, there's guys that watch their area. And then there's, for example, in the Quebec League and the Ontario League, a little bit easier to get to games. We have well over 16 to 20 scouts on our staff.
Now, as our conversation closes in on the hour mark, and I know you got a ton of other things to do, I've only got a couple of more questions left for you in this very enlightening conversation. When talking about the different scouts and the different areas, how often does a scouting department convene? Do you guys get together at all digitally or physically, or do you just pass on your notes to higher instances?
So what we do is we have our notes we put in our computer, obviously, and it goes to our head guys, and they all get to see that. But we get together at least, let's see, twice. In the last 2 years, we haven't because of COVID. So it's been mostly Zoom calls or virtual meetings, but we do get together usually at least 2-3 times a season.
Now, to round up this conversation, and you don't have to answer the question in case someone's feelings do get hurt, and you got some ties to it, because obviously your son-in-law is still playing National Hockey League hockey, but what player moved your needle the furthest? What player did you see? Doesn't matter at what point of the scouting process that made you go like, whoa, he's a player.
Just with the skill part, I'll just go with Anaheim Zegras, but mind you, I didn't watch him. I saw him play on video, and that's about it. But he's done a pretty good job with his skill. He does some stuff that brings you to your feet, and you say, wow, those are some pretty good moves. And those are the moves that some of the Czech players taught me. So,
perfect way to end this conversation. Thank you so much for enlightening me and my audience about the scouting process, about your time in Italy. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Wish you all the best, and hope to have you back at some point here on Unibet Hockey O'Clock.
Thank you so much, Martin, and cheers to everybody there. Prost.
Exzellente Unterhaltung mit dem schönsten Sport der Welt.
Unibet Hockey O'Clock.